everyone. My name's Mary Tivy, and welcome back to the Animal Health Surveillance Podcast. So we have a special guest with us today. I'm delighted to announce that James Russell, who is the president of the BVA, is here to have a chat to us about surveillance and the role that the BVA plays within this.
So hi, James. It's great to have you on the Animal Health Surveillance Podcast today. Thanks so much for coming down to speak to us.
Pleasure to be here. Lovely to meet you, Mary.
Brilliant. So, I guess if we get started, I think the first question it would be good to talk about is, from your point of view, you know, what's the importance of animal health surveillance?
I think it's really an interesting time to be talking about that when we're a year into a global pandemic, which is ultimately a zoonotic disease. And I think that's perhaps where we would see the greatest importance, is thinking about this as a One Health issue, and thinking about the importance, really, I suppose, of the vets as being the eyes and ears of animal health and welfare on farms, you know, but also with domestic animals as well. But, you know, if we focus on our farm species, you know, we are that first point of call, aren't we, to be looking not just at the endemic diseases in our country and identifying where those are, but also for being that early warning system for unusual or exotic diseases coming to the fore. And again, you know, we talk about sort of prescient timing. Here we are almost exactly 20 years after a private vet identified foot and mouth in a slaughterhouse. And, you know, that vet's actions are, you know, that was a horrendous time. You know, we know the numbers of animals, millions of animals that died you know, to control that outbreak. But that vet's actions, the astute awareness that they had that there was something not right here, and that they were then able to involve those other agencies, the government agencies, the laboratory agencies, to say there's something not quite right here. Who knows? I'm sure people have tried to model, but I certainly couldn't try and predict, you know, what would have happened if that hadn't happened that day, if it had been a week later or 10 days later that event had occurred. And I think... you know, so we identify these things, you know, in the first instance, but also looking across species is something that I think vets are very well equipped to do, and particularly again through using our government agencies and the importance of things like the quarterly surveillance reports that we see coming out from APHA and the regular reports that we get in the vet record, thinking about how is there any evidence that diseases are crossing species, and is that something we should be concerned about? Again, you know, you can bring it back to where we are today and think about the reports of, you know, is coronavirus causing myocarditis in cats? Is it not? Should we be worried beyond the individual cats who are affected? You know, those are really fundamental questions that vets play a crucial role in helping to answer for, as I said, bringing it full circle, for that One Health piece for our whole society.
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's really interesting that you've brought up, obviously, you know, the position we're in at the moment, and, you know, thinking about that, you know, vet's role in, you know, going across species and how just important it is, the role that vets play within surveillance. Yeah.
I think there's probably another aspect to that as well, isn't there, which is probably more, if I say more parochial, I don't mean that in a derogatory way at all, but is more fundamental to our role as veterinary surgeons and the oath that we've all taken, which is, you know, being custodians and guardians of animal health and welfare. And, you know, using the clinical skills that we have to identify where something isn't quite right as well. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're so committed, really, to that relationship between vets, their clients, and the clients' animals. And we talk about it again in a sort of undercare position, which again is something up for discussion at the moment, and feeds in, I would suggest, to this whole ability of the profession to be those eyes and ears, is what we term the vet client patient relationship. Slightly more challenging to apply that on a farm scale, but what you can absolutely see is the importance of being a vet regularly in contact with those animals to pick up changes and pick up unusual events.
Yeah, certainly. I think highlighting, you know, that is really important. And yeah, if we think about, you know, obviously, you know, the importance of surveillance, I mean, What do you think perhaps are the issues associated with the surveillance system at the moment?
So, you know, I was involved in the, I can't remember what they called it now, was it the Surveillance 14 project anyway, but the project at which they looked at rationalising the number of APHA labs. And I think, you know, those facilities closing at that time has changed the relationship, I think, between farmers and those labs, but also between vets and those labs. I think up until that period, we had very close and very easy access to our local veterinary inspector teams, and we would know them by name, we would have their mobiles in our phones, we'd be contacting them from farms, just saying, what about this? Is this one I should be sending in? Which bits of this one should I send in? Have you seen others like this week? And I think, you know, those communications have changed. And, you know, 2016, our Voice of the Veterinary Profession survey showed that people then felt those changes. And, you know, 70% of vets at that point felt that their communication with their local veterinary investigation officers had been worsened since 2014. So for me, I think there's a fundamental here, which is that we would be absolutely opposed to any further cuts of government funding in that network, because having just extolled the virtues of the private vet and that on-farm relationship, the third wheel to that, without any shadow of a doubt, is that support of those state agencies who have that perhaps greater regional oversight, but also potentially that greater expertise in the conditions that we're talking about and the requirements to be able to diagnose, predict and prevent as well. So, you know, we worked from that position and said, BVA needed to have a policy position on this, and we launched that in 2018. So, you know, it's available on our website and have a look at it. It makes all sorts of recommendations, some of which now look slightly out of date, because they talk about as the UK moves towards leaving the European Union. But I think if you simply reread that as now the UK has left the European Union, they, you know, pretty well hold up as still being as valid as they were, you know, on the day that we wrote them. But, you know, in summary, our key recommendations there are that, you know, we need to maintain government resource spending, but also that we need to be quite dynamic in terms of adapting and adopting new ways of recording information and collating that information and feeding it back as well. And part of that, I think, is overcoming some of the human behavioural challenges of, you know, not wanting to tell anyone that you've got this sort of dirty secret on the farm, and finding ways that can incentivize that and move away from a kind of, you know, it's a dirty secret culture onto this is just part of what we need to do to improve the overall health and welfare of our farmed population right across the four nations of the United Kingdom. I think, you know, that's a real sort of communications challenge, I would suggest, both for government, but also for vets and potentially for farming leaders as well. And, you know, by doing that, by keeping that funding, by keeping that dialogue open, what I would hope is that allows us to keep the expertise within those government agencies, because, you know, if we don't use them, those people aren't going to stay, are they? You know, they're not going to be there next time one of us in the front line wants to report that we've got a slightly unusual sheep with its tongue coming off in a slaughterhouse or whatever it might be. You know, we need to keep those people there. They're crucially, crucially important.
Yeah. And it was interesting what you said there about being kind of dynamic in the ways of, you know, perhaps we need to move forward with collecting information and things like that. I mean, do you think there's a specific way that that's going to be moving in the future?
I think there's all sorts of things coming together at the moment. I really do feel like we're in a kind of stars are aligning world at the minute. When you look at things like the Livestock Information Programme coming to the fore to enable farmers to have much better understanding of what it is that they're buying onto their farm, what those animals are that are coming onto the farm. I was learning just yesterday about an app. I'm sure our listeners are probably all, it's old hat for all of them, but it was new to me yesterday. But an app which is free at the point of use for a farmer to be able to record any daily live weight gain, medicines usage, surveillance data on their farms on, and they only then sort of pay a subscription to it if they want to use that data to inform any purchasers coming to their farms of what that data told them. And it's a lovely use of technology, which it's not hard to see how you expand that out to become part of our sort of disease surveillance network as well. And what I would hope is that when that data becomes big enough, that hopefully we can get in front of disease and be much better at a kind of predict and prevent model of disease reduction in the country, particularly think about some of our endemic diseases. The one that would really stick in my mind from my time in practice would be IVR in cattle, and saying, yeah, that's devastating when that gets into a naive herd. What more information could I have as a veterinary surgeon to understand which of my clients it was appropriate to be recommending IBR vaccination for, and which of them might I be having a slightly different conversation with? And how can we use the data that's available to us to better enable those conversations?
Yeah, it's a really interesting subject, isn't it? I think, yeah. So, I mean, obviously we've talked about some of the issues associated with surveillance, but do you think there's, you know, perhaps in terms of vets or I guess anybody really, do you think there are any misconceptions surrounding surveillance or the system?
For me, I think probably the biggest misconception is more that surveillance is taken for granted. And, you know, we've touched, haven't we, on what's happened over the last 12 months. But the other obvious one, which we haven't mentioned at the moment, would be avian influenza and the importance of what's just happened through this winter. And, you know, I've just been down the garden to see my chickens this morning and let them know that in a week's time they'll be able to be released to clear the vegetable patch for us as we begin to prepare it for this season. But, you know, they, like every other member of the poultry clan in the country, have spent the winter locked away. And they've done that because that surveillance network got to a point where we understood what the risks were across the country, not just in farm birds, but also in wild birds. We were able as well, by doing that, by having that really joined up and comprehensive surveillance network, for the first time, we've really seen the importance of that in terms of our exports to the rest of the European Union. Because we've been able to use regionalization and look at where those restriction zones need to be to enable trading to continue across the rest of the country. You know, that hasn't happened by accident. That's happened because there've been some very committed people working incredibly hard over this winter period to make sure that we can have the confidence that where we're saying avian influenza is, that it is. And equally as importantly, that where we're saying it isn't, it genuinely isn't. And I say for the first time, I think we've really seen that as vets in the front line, as we've been being asked to sign export health certificates for many of us for the first time in our careers, you know, verifying that these animals have come from regions that are avian influenza free. We can only sign that certificate because of that surveillance network that sits behind us.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear, Anthony, and it's really interesting to hear you, you know, having that personal experience of that, you know, not even perhaps to do, you know, just in your kind of like your personal life as well, and how it's impacted you, you know, that way. Yeah. So in terms of, you know, obviously, I think we've touched on a bit, little bit on this, but we've talked about some issues and misconceptions. But, you know, what do you think perhaps needs to be done to combat these?
I would say there's probably a number of levels to that. And you know, perhaps beginning right with our own undergraduates, and I should preface this statement by saying, you know, I am not for one instant suggesting there should be more added to the undergraduate curriculum. You know, we've got a huge wealth of knowledge being taken in by our veterinary students already, and that's it's absolutely fantastic and a credit to all of us. But I think. There are opportunities for us to re-emphasize and build on the importance of public health generally as a public good and as part of the veterinary role. And as part of that, of course, we will be encouraging people into greater engagement with our surveillance networks. But I think the other side of it would be coming from the administrative side, from the government side of that. And, you know, I've already alluded to it a bit, but it's really important that you recognise, you government recognise the importance of what's being done here, and don't try and think that we can do this, you know, on a thinner shoestring than already we are, because as I've already said, now more than ever, this is crucial to all of the exports of meat and products of animal origin that the country is undertaking. And of course, that does include trade within our country to an extent as well, when you think about GB to Northern Ireland trade and you know, the particular challenges that we face there. So for the importance of just keeping that trade moving, if nothing else, we need our strong surveillance network. That's quite aside from all of those health and welfare issues that you know, we've started this conversation with, because as vets, I think that's where our foremost focus rests. I think from government, there is that financial and trade imperative as well.
Yeah, certainly. Very true. And it's, very interesting to hear, really. Yeah. So obviously, you know, from the BVA point of view, are there any ways that the BVA is trying to perhaps encourage or promote, you know, engagement with surveillance, you know, for vets now in practice?
Sure. So, I mean, look, I mentioned our 2018 policy and the fact that, you know, that carries a number of recommendations, including, you know, whole chapters on the importance of articulating the findings of surveillance and of working collaboratively to improve communication. Now, you know, that I don't think is one that BVA can solve by itself, but I hope that we, you know, that we try and walk the walk on that. So if we come back to avian influenza this winter, you know, we've been very supportive of trying to keep the public messaging going out, but aimed at both poultry keepers, but also at vets, of, you know, this is where we're up to. This is what you need to do. This is why it's important. These are the simple steps you need to take. And, you know, I think that's just a very minor example of that day-to-day engagement, which is needed to keep this fresh in the public mind. In terms of where BVA sits on this, I think just helping within that lobbying space to government to recognise the importance of vets is something that we're very actively engaged in. And again, perhaps now in a slightly different and arguably more sort of crucial way than ever, as we think about those vets as part of our exporting trade as well. And we acknowledge that, you know, that sort of frontline slaughterhouse surveillance work has been a hugely important part of the network over recent years, and that on the whole, that has been done by non-UK EU citizens coming into the country to carry that work out. I think at the last count, 95% of people doing that frontline work were EU citizens. And there are different challenges now in terms of being able to employ those people, being able to get them into those positions. Because of the changes to immigration requirements post leaving the European Union. So I think where BVA sit there is just to try and be supportive and challenging of government as they look at different approaches to how we might help to backfill that gap, really, recognising that, you know, as I've already said, you know, we've got more veterinary students being trained now than ever before. But even if all of those students came out and wanted to work in slaughterhouse surveillance, there's a very decent time lag between now and them coming out equipped and ready to do that. So we need to do things right now, and BVA are working with government and with the Royal College in that space to understand how can we make sure that numbers of vets don't become a limiting factor to the important animal health and welfare and food safety aspects of that active surveillance network.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. And obviously, especially in light of, you know, the way that things are changing at the moment. Yeah, it's interesting to hear that. How obviously you're trying to support that, because it's obviously such a crucial part of the system. Yeah, And I think we mentioned a little bit earlier about, you mentioned about the BVA have the surveillance policy, which is accessible on the website, which has a bit more information about this. But is there any other information that you provide, you know, about surveillance for vets out in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. People can get involved with the policy. We ran a campaign after we launched the policy, and you know, we continue to try and raise that awareness. But we do have a specific page as well. How and where can I contribute to animal disease surveillance? And that looks right through from, you know, what do I need to do if I suspect a notifiable disease? How can I best collect this surveillance data? And there's regional differences from that amongst the devolved, you know, devolved nations. And, you know, we would encourage people to sort of refer to those if they're in a position where they're having to undertake that work. You know, they're there on the website, they're there for people to use, and they should be pretty well up to date. So combination, I suppose, really, Mary, of trying to be proactive in raising the importance of it, but also hopefully giving people the background data that they can fall back on if they need to, because I don't know about you, but I certainly can't hold all of these names, addresses, details of what I need for when in my head at the same time. So knowing that there's a page on a website means it doesn't have to be in my forebrain.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, having a resource that you can go and find those things out on is always a really useful thing, isn't it, when you're out and about? Yeah, yeah. Oh, brilliant. It's great to know that. And I'm sure, yeah, as I say, that's, you know, really good thing to be able to, you know, tell people that that's there if they need it. So, so yeah, well, thank you, James. That's been a really interesting chat. So thank you so much for coming to talk to us today and, yeah, for discussing this with us.
Thank you for inviting me in, and good luck with the rest of the PhD.
So thank you very much to James again for being part of the episode today and for coming on to share his thoughts with us. Check out the next episode. It's going to be the second of our two-part discussion with Finn Toomey from the APHA. And this new episode is called What Can Surveillance Do For You? So if you're interested in finding out the benefits that surveillance can have to you as a vet out in practice, then tune in 2 weeks' time for that. If you like the series, please do mention it to your friends and your colleagues. And for any news and updates, you can follow me on Twitter at the AHS Podcast. I'd love to hear from you. Again, if there's anything you want me to cover or any topics that you think might be interesting, then do get in touch. You can either leave your suggestions on Twitter or on the podcast website. Thanks so much for listening again today, and hopefully see you again for the next episode.